Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford with the April 26, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way on KZOX and Z the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. It is impossible to know what our world would look like today had the events of September 11th and the first year of our new millennium not occurred, or if the U.S. had responded more humanely in the days, now years, that followed. We can surmise, however, that it couldn't have been much worse, and I am speaking of just what has been happening within the United States. Outside our borders, disasters can be seen in whatever direction one chooses to look. A week ago Sunday, it was the Turkish elections, where, if one chooses to believe the government's report of the closed vote tally, a slim majority of those not imprisoned approved giving President Recep Tayyip Erdogan complete dictatorial control of what is no longer a democracy but remains a key U.S. ally. Today I will be looking at Venezuela, where each new day brings that country on the shores of the Caribbean ever closer to complete collapse, although some may argue that it already has. Only who is mainly responsible for this human calamity remains a question. My guest to discuss the situation and latest events there will be a Venezuelan friend, Professor Pedro Longshoreon, from the University of San Francisco's Department of Latin American Studies. He was last on this program in April of a year ago, discussing Venezuela's descent into the maelstrom and the Western left's inability to understand it. According to Pedro Longshoreon, both problems have only gotten worse. So tune in at 20 minutes past the hour to hear our discussion of the subject. Much of the Western world's attention this past Sunday was focused on France, where in the preliminary voting for president, as expected, far-right candidate Marine Le Pen of the National Front Party won 21.3% of the vote to secure a place in the May 7th runoff against Emmanuel Macron of the New En Marche Party, who topped the 11-candidate field with 24.1% of the tally. As anticipated, following the announcement of the results, the defeated candidates from the traditional major parties set aside their differences to offer their support for Macron in opposition to Le Pen, who, like her U.S. counterpart Donald Trump, campaigned largely on an anti-immigrant platform and taking France out of the European Union. The final vote on May 7th is likely to be a repeat of the 2002 election when her father and founder of the National Front, the unabashed anti-Semite Jean-Marie Le Pen, also finished second in the balloting behind the incumbent and eventual winner Jacques Chirac. What was as significant about Sunday's vote was that the two parties that have long dominated French politics, the Republicans and the Socialists, were swept aside by the voters. The Republican candidate François Fillon, the early favorite until dragged down by nepotism scandals, garnered 20.1% of the vote, and Benoît Hamon, candidate of the Socialists, the party of France's unpopular current president, François Hollande, limped in at 6.3%. The candidate favored by what there is of a left in France, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, from another new party, La France Insoumise, or France Unsubdued, finished fourth with 19.58% after newspapers as far away as Australia reported that financial markets were spooked by the prospect of a Le Pen-Mélenchon runoff. One might have said the same of the markets here had Bernie Sanders been the Democratic Party candidate instead of Hillary Clinton. That the candidacy of Trump, whose world viewpoint is not dissimilar from that of Le Pen, did not raise concerns on Wall Street despite his occasional fulminations against it, might be seen as an indication how far the American public has moved to the right or, as it turned out, Goldman Sachs and the dons of Wall Street knew their man better than those who voted for him. In my last program, I noted that Trump's decision to launch 59 Tomahawk missiles at a Syrian airbase following unsubstantiated reports that the Syrians had dropped bombs containing deadly sarin gas, killing between 60 and 70 people in the town of Khan Shaykhun in the Idlib province, had elevated his standing in the polls and among his critics. What I suspect what you haven't heard is that the Kurdish press, citing reports from the scene, reported the gas that caused the casualties was not sarin, but chlorine. In any case, each of the Tomahawk missiles cost the taxpayers about $1 million apiece, but none of it will come out from Trump's pocket. Quite the opposite, in fact, since he reported owning stock in Raytheon when he began his run for the White House, and there's no report that he's divested from it. Whether he owns an interest in the company that makes the GBU-4 call MOAB, Massive Ordnance Air Blast, or Mother of All Bombs, depending on who you ask, that was dropped in Afghanistan near the Pakistan border on April 13th, ostensibly targeting ISIS fighters hiding in tunnels, has not been reported, nor what its use had actually accomplished. Moreover, why was ISIS being targeted in Afghanistan, where the fighting against the U.S.-backed government and U.S.-trained army is being carried out almost exclusively by the Taliban? Well, the original intention of the 21,000-pound bomb was to act as a non-nuclear deterrent against Saddam Hussein. The goal is to have the pressure be so great that Saddam cooperates, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said in a 2003 interview. Short of that, he said, an unwillingness to cooperate, the goal is to have the capabilities of the coalition so clear and so obvious that there is an enormous disincentive for the Iraqi military to fight against the coalition, end quote. Well, during testing, the weapon reportedly created a mushroom cloud that could be seen 20 miles away from the blast. Each MOAB cost around $16 million, according to a military information website. 20 of these bombs have reportedly been made at a cost to the taxpayers of $314 million. In 2008, an article at the Eglin Air Force Base newsletter where the bomb was tested asked, quote, "What's worse than unleashing on society the wrath of the largest non-nuclear bomb yet to be made? Letting the world know it's out there and ready to be used any moment," end quote. That's apparently what Trump has been demonstrating, and from the positive support he's received from liberals in the U.S. media and the political illiterates who haven't the faintest idea what his war is about, his willingness to use force is what has now made him presidential. Put quotes around that. Even when he makes a fool of himself, as he's dangerous, as he proved when he announced that a U.S. naval armada was heading toward the waters off North Korea, when in fact they were steaming in the opposite direction. Well, they quickly turned around, and on Monday, the Japanese government announced that its navy is sending two destroyers to join the American armada as it steams toward the Korean Peninsula. Washington, incidentally, sent the USS Carl Vinson, initially sent the USS Carl Vinson group to the region as a symbol of American strength to show Kim Jong-un how tough we are, what is in store for his country if it continues to defy the U.S. by testing ballistic missiles or nuclear warheads. North Korea immediately responded to the military mobilization, according to Reuters, citing a North Korea state newspaper that said, quote, "The United States should not run amok and should consider carefully any catastrophic consequence from its foolish military provocative act. What's only laid for aggression is dead bodies," end quote. President Trump had earlier sent his Vice President Mike Pence to the region, hoping to scare the pants off Kim Jong-un. Speaking from the deck of an aircraft carrier, Pence told the 2,500 sailors obliged to hear him at Tokyo's U.S. Yokosuka Naval Base that, quote, "United States of America will always seek peace, but under President Trump, the shield stands guard and the sword stands ready," end quote. It seems that Trump is not the only clown in Washington. A week ago Monday, Pence visited the Demilitarized Zone, the DMZ, that divides North and South Korea. The Washington Post reported that although Pence wasn't supposed to step outside, he did anyway. Why? So North Koreans could get a load of him displaying his tough jaw in their direction. Seriously. "I thought it was important that we went outside," Pence said, according to the Washington Post. "I thought it was important that people on the other side of the DMZ see our resolve in my face." End quote. That remark raised more than a few laughs on Saturday's NPR news quiz, "Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me." The situation, however, is deadly serious, as indicated by a report that the entire Senate will be briefed on it this morning by War Secretary Jim Mattis, the Butcher of Fallujah, and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and others at the White House this morning. The Lawyers Committee for Nuclear Policy has sent out a notice urging people to call your senators and urge them to demand a peaceful resolution of this extremely dangerous confrontation. In the prisons of Israel, in the meantime, over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, who according to international law shouldn't have been there in the first place, went on a hunger strike, led by Marwan Barghouti, considered by some to be his people's Nelson Mandela. Why they shouldn't be in those prisons is made quite clear by the international law. It strictly forbids an occupying country, in this instance Israel, from imprisoning inhabitants of the land they are occupying in its prisons. But of course, Israel states pays no attention to international laws, and tragically for its victims, like America's many more, neither is it ever called to account. What outraged some Israelis, but incredibly, the New York Times afforded space on its op-ed page to an essay by Barghouti explaining why he and his fellow prisoners had initiated the hunger strike. From Israel's Hadarim prison on August 16th, where he had been moved immediately when the strike began, Barghouti wrote, quote, "Having spent the last 15 years in an Israeli prison, I have been both a witness to and a victim of Israel's illegal system of mass arbitrary arrests and ill treatment of Palestinian prisoners. After exhausting all the other options, I decided there was no choice but to resist these abuses by going on a hunger strike. Some 1,000 Palestinians," he wrote, "1,000 Palestinian prisoners have decided to take part in this hunger strike, which begins today. The day we observe here is Prisoners' Day. Hunger striking is the most peaceful form of resistance available. It inflicts pain solely on those who participate and on their loved ones, in the hopes that their empty stomachs and their sacrifice will help them send the message and resonate beyond the confines of their dark cells. Decades of experience have proved that Israel's inhumane system of colonial and military occupation aims to break the spirit of prisoners and the nation to which they belong by inflicting suffering on their bodies, separating them from their families and communities, using humiliating measures to compel subjugation. In spite of such treatment, we will not surrender to it." End quote. That was how Palestinian political prisoner Marwan Barghouti began his article in the New York Times, where it can still be found online. Barghouti, first jailed when he was 15, is currently serving 5 life terms in Hadarim prison for crimes he was alleged to have been responsible for during the Second Intifada that lasted from 2000 to 2004. The paper now offers an apology for not having described his alleged crimes and not identifying Barghouti as a terrorist, the appellation that Israel applies to any Palestinian that offers more than token resistance to its illegal occupation of their homeland. Israel's sadistic treatment of Palestinians, about which I previously commented, was on full display outside of the Ofer prison, where most of the Palestinian striking prisoners are being held. The Brooklyn-based Jewish Press, the leading publication for ultra-Orthodox Jews, cheerfully reported that, quote, "starting at 12 p.m. today, Thursday, April 20th, 2017, young National Union Ikud Lumai activists are hosting a free barbecue outside the Ofer prison on Route 443 just outside of Jerusalem. Grilling the food just outside the prison walls," their correspondent reported. "The delicious smell wafts through the prison, and their intention is to taunt the convicted PA terrorists who are hunger striking to receive 5-star accommodations and privileges," end quote. The article, continuing in the same vein, was accompanied by photos of what appeared to be shish kebab cooking on outdoor barbecue grills. It should be mentioned that the same newspaper, before it went online, celebrated the murder of 29 Palestinians and the wounding of 125 more by a Brooklyn-born doctor, Baruch Goldstein, on February 25, 1994, while they were bent in prayer at the Cave of the Patriarchs in occupied Hebron. By no accident, it was the Jewish holiday of Purim, which venerates another massacre, this one of Persians in biblical times. News of that would probably not be regarded as self-defense by the 90 U.S. senators, would probably be regarded as self-defense by the 90 U.S. senators and the more than 300 members of the House who have signed letters scripted by Israel's U.S. lobby, AIPAC, to the new U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, calling on him to have U.N. institutions treat Israel more fairly. It is just one of scores of such letters that have been written on Israel's behalf for almost a half century by our Israeli preoccupied Congress. And as far as I can tell, no other country has been blessed with such bipartisan U.S. support. I am pleased to let you know that neither Dianne Feinstein nor Jared Huffman are among the signatures, nor is Bernie Sanders. Sorry, I can't say the same for our new Senator Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren, who has shown the ability to get on her knees for AIPAC in Israel as quickly as any of her colleagues. If that wasn't Congress's subservience to Israel, if that wasn't already disgusting beyond words, Two Republican House members, Florida's Ron DeSantis and Ohio's Bill Johnson, plan to launch the Congressional Israel Victory Caucus, CIVC, tomorrow at 9 a.m. The caucus goal is to introduce a new U.S. approach to Israel-Palestinian relations. Johnson notes that, quote, Israel is America's closest ally in the Middle East, and the community of nations must accept that Israel has the right to exist, period. That is not negotiable now nor ever. According to the press release put out by the Middle East Forum, a far-right pro-Israel nonprofit, the Congressional Israel Victory Caucus aims to focus on this precept and to better inform our colleagues in Congress about daily life in Israel and the present-day conflict, end quote. It probably wouldn't make any difference if they or the senators who have been conditioned to bow down to Israel were informed that the hated ISIS apologized to Israel for attacking its soldiers on the Golan Heights, as the Times of Israel reported on Monday. According to the paper, quote, former Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon on Saturday said the Islamic State terrorist group in the Syrian Golan Heights, quote unquote, apologized for attacking an Israeli unit. There was one case recently with Daesh opened fire and apologized, Yaalon said, using the terror group's Arabic nickname. That's not their nickname, that is their name, in fact. This was an apparent reference to a clash that took place near the Syrian border last November, noted the paper, in which IDF troops exchanged fire with members of the Islamic State affiliate. After a brief gun battle, the Israeli military attacked the terrorist group with airstrikes and tank fire, killing four of them, end quote. Israel has made no secret of its providing medical aid and hospital care for any fighter wounded by in battle against the Syrian government, regardless of which organization they represent. While Prime Minister President Benjamin Netanyahu has stated on more than one occasion that Iran is a greater threat to Israel and the world than is ISIS. But that is something like this story that you won't hear on Fox News, MSNBC, or NPR. Nor are you likely to hear anywhere else that on March 30th, a federal judge in the Washington District Circuit, Tanya Shutkin, found it, quote, neither logical nor plausible for the CIA to claim it had no intelligence budget data showing what it provided Israel between 1990 and 2015, which was the subject of a Freedom of Information request by Grant Smith, director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, who has been a frequent guest on this program. On August 5, 2015, Smith noted, President Obama quantified the possible dollar value of such intelligence aid in a speech at American University, claiming, quote, due to American military and intelligence assistance, which my administration has provided at unprecedented levels, Israel can defend itself against any conventional danger, end quote. At a minimum, Smith calculates, that additional intelligence aid amounted to at least $1.9 billion annually on top of the $3 billion-plus Israel was already receiving. Judge Shukin ordered the Department of Justice Legal Counsel in response to her order by April 24th. But when the Justice Department lawyer did instead was to ask the judge for a reconsideration of the case and for a summary dismissal to which Smith has filed his objections. I'll have more in this case on May 24th when Grant Smith will again be my guest and we will be speaking about the state of U.S.-Israel relations in the Trump administration. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.